Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from a lawn chair on top of a platform, on top of four ladders, on top of another platform, on top of a roof, overlooking San Francisco here in 2020. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Isco. What I love about that is that like 10 people have seen this movie. So like that joke really plays for like
that's why I really had to paint the visual picture. But one of the 10 people who have seen this movie is our guest, Chandler Levac.
Indeed.
Writer, director. She is also a critic for the Globe and Mail. That's in Toronto. My understanding is you're not supposed to call it where it's from, but that's just, you know, that's the American me. Chandler, thank you for coming. Good to see you.
Thank you. I'm so honored to be here. As one of an exclusive club,
yes,
of people that have watched Guinevere.
Guinevere yeah, heads,
it's us. Guinevere heads. I think you could just call us the Guineveres.
I mean, by the way,
the other seven people will love that joke.
So Chandler, thank you so much for being here. And I know that you had not seen this movie, and I don't want to say I suggested it, but I guess I kind of suggested it. The Sarah Pauly of it all, you know, Canada, all of that. But I don't know, like, am I crazy? But this movie's kind of great.
Yeah, it's one of those movies I feel like I'd seen the VHS cover. Like, it's like emblazoned in my brain, you know? I feel like I've walked past Guinevere through like the blockbusters of decades and eons.
Sure.
And I guess I always thought the movie was a completely different movie than what it was. Like, I guess I thought it was this kind of fanciful, like almost like a, like the Princess Diaries or something.
Yeah, oh, interesting.
Yeah. You know, like a really like romantic kind of fantasia, but it's actually like an acid satire of like men's projections on women and like the sick, twisted games they play with manic pixie dream girls.
Yeah, I think you just nailed it. I don't think you're crazy, Phil. I think this movie is tremendous. I knew nothing. This has been on our list from the beginning, right? So
yeah.
I just kind of went to I basically went to three separate Wikipedia pages in the beginning of this and pulled anything that could be called a 1999 movie and threw it on our list. And among those are things that I've never heard of, including Guinevere. Never heard of it. Ever, ever, ever. Probably thought we were never actually going to do it.
Yes.
I'm so happy we did. I can't. I'm going to spend the next 2 hours trying to explain why I love this movie so much. But I didn't just like it. I loved this movie. It was. Yeah. Here's what I think. We do a lot on this podcast. You know, 20 movies are 21 years old. We do a lot of pointing out, and I don't know if we're that proud of this anymore, Phil. But a lot of pointing out how problematic.
Were we proud at some point about
it? Yeah, really? I think at the beginning of the podcast, like we were like, "American Beauty's problematic." And we were really excited about that. Our American Pie is problematic. Look, we talked
about
toxic
masculinity.
Yeah, we figured it out. You guys did not get what we were doing back then. Okay. This movie is not that problematic through a 2020 lens because it's dealt with so matter-of-factly, non-judgmentally. It made me look at a relationship like this, older man, younger woman, in a lot of different ways. And I think that before this movie was made, I'd say from the beginning of time until about 1998, older man, younger woman relationships were just kind of considered an okay thing, a thing that happened.
Yeah,
and some people still think they're okay.
Well,
like the Woody Allen movie, you know.
Yes.
Your like relationship construct.
Some people still think they're okay, and put a pin in that thought for a second.
Yeah.
In the last 3, 4, 5, maybe 10 years, we've started to use the term predator when talking about an older man and a younger woman who is of age.
Or grooming too seems to be a new thing.
Well,
too.
Grooming tends to be younger than that. I believe the idea with grooming is a man who like knows that he shouldn't be sleeping with Lolita just yet, but once she turns 18, he will have implanted so many thoughts into her head about how wonderful he is. He
can incepted her with his greatness,
which is kind of what it is. And I've seen arguments. There's an argument that this movie I think is making. That's a very unpopular argument this day, but I think is worth making, which is people are allowed to make their own choices. And just because a man is 54 and a woman is 21 doesn't necessarily mean that the relationship is toxic. Now, there are toxic elements to this relationship, no doubt about it. And he does some horrible things to her over the course of this relationship. But it's nuanced enough, and it contains both points of view in a way. And it's Sarah Polley's performance is really helpful in this respect, where you don't walk away thinking you just watched a story about a predatory monster. You also watched a story – you also watched kind of a heartbreaking love story that – where your heart actually kind of breaks for how sad this older man is in the end of the day and why he feels the need to do that. So there's so many instances and little moves that the director Audrey Wells made to kind of clue you into where your sympathy should lie, where your empathy should lie, and how afraid you should be for Sarah Polley's character throughout that we'll get into. But yeah, I was fucking blown away by it, like straight up.
Yeah, I mean, of the three of us, I'm the only one that saw this film back in something close to 99. I don't know if it was actually in 1999.
I can't believe you've seen this. Wow.
I saw it because, I love Sarah Polley. And I was like, Sarah Polley is in a movie. She wasn't in that many of them. So I was like, this is exciting. And I remember watching it and thinking that she was great. And my recollection of it, looking backwards, ultimately is I remember it had a downer of an ending. I remember that he died. I remember that there was this sort of black cloud over it and that it didn't end the way that I thought it was going to. I went into it back then thinking the same thing, which is this an older guy, younger woman, very kind of Woody Allen-esque in terms of this, like, you know, artistry and find your inner voice and all this kind of stuff that he projected onto her. And I liked it fine, but like it didn't leave a tremendous impact on me. But I remember thinking Sarah Polley was great. So watching it, like going into this watch for this episode, I was worried. Like I was like, is this movie, and I hate to use the term, Kenny, but is this movie going to be problematic? Like, did I watch this movie in 99 and think nothing of it, and now today it's predatory and gross and terrible? But to exactly what you guys are saying, Audrey Wells finds a way to sort of, you know, cut the legs under from out that argument and really turn him into this very tragic character. You know, the Jean Smart character, which we'll talk about, is tremendous. She gives an unbelievable performance and has a scene that just, I think, cracks this movie wide open. It's a much more impressive movie, especially now. In terms of, you know what I mean, in terms of how, you know, smartly it sort of dodges these landmines. And I guess, you know, Chandler, with you, you know, you're a writer director. You know, you obviously, you have, you know, I've read your recent script and it's great. It has a male character. It has, you know, when you're writing men, do you, you know, how do you sort of approach that so that giving them the sort of multiple dimensions? Because I feel like a man writing and directing this movie is going to be a very, very different exercise, is my point. And I guess I just want to know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, something I've been thinking about a lot, because I feel like, Audrey Wells, I think, is a really interesting filmmaker. And before this, she'd written the screenplay to The Truth About Cats and Dogs, which is indeed a little bit of a subversive romantic comedy as well, that centers, you know, Janine Garofalo and really points out to kind of the insecurities and flaws of the Uma Thurman character. And I feel like it's just such a shame that more people don't know about this movie as like an you know, feminist kind of masterpiece, because it totally slipped through my fingers. And I wonder how much of that was just like the marketing that the Weinsteins were doing at the time of the film.
Or lack thereof.
The trailer, like, it really makes it look like, it really does lean into that kind of like May-December romance, Woody Allen fantasy of it all. And then you watch it and it's actually like a pretty subversive like criticism of that, where it's kind of pointing at like kind of the bleak realities of what this experience would actually be like for this woman. And it is a coming of age story for her, and I think for him too, but it's like at the end, like, she kind of just accepts it. But back to your original point.
Yeah, no, please. Yeah.
You know, I have been thinking about that a lot, because I think a lot of times when women make movies, because I think there is such a lack of female representation in cinema for so long, where women got to be kind of the center of their own stories, you're sort of positioned that if you are making kind of a feature film as a female writer director, you're going to have a female protagonist at the center of it. But I think there actually is like the next gap of representation maybe for women making movies is to write male characters. Because I think women writing stories about men is really essential. And, you know, having women see men and tell the stories through a male perspective, but also creating maybe male stories that are how women see men, you know, is really important to me, and challenging. I mean, in my case, I mostly either write them based on the guys that I know, or just write me, and then the person is like always crying. So I don't know if I'm writing like really, you know, wonderful male characters.
Like, writing you, writing me, who knows? I mean,
it's like they always have cramps in the middle of the movie for no reason for a few days. And
But I think, but ultimately, and to sort of piggyback on what you're saying here, you know, I think that Audrey Wells, who, you know, Truth About Cats and Dogs, she wrote that. She wrote and directed Under the Tuscan Sun. She also directed, relatively recently, she did The Hate U Give, and unfortunately passed away shortly around its release. Yeah. She was a really interesting filmmaker that I think was sort of deceptively kind of put in this box, at least with Truth About Cats and Dogs, Under the Tuscan Sun, and Guinevere, of like rom-com, like that's where you need to be, in that kind of box.
Yeah.
And I think that they are deceptive in terms of that seeming like what they're about.
Well, that's where a lot of
like Nicole Holofcener's in her career, or like I don't know how to say her name, but
Nicole Jolodenko, right?
And that would have been amazing. She could have had been like the female Woody Allen, and if there's like a alternate timeline for her, And it's something that, I mean, this movie won the Waldo Salt Screenplay Award at Sundance.
Yeah. When that's cool. Here. Okay.
So, you look at her filmography on IMDb, and I mean, look, I've already kind of said how much I like this movie. I like it better than anything Nicole Holofcener or Lisa Charlton-Denko has ever done. I think this is a better film. This is really, really strong to me. Mm-hmm. The thing about looking at Audrey Wells' career is she clearly had a very successful career. When you write so many different studio movies in so many different genres, you're clearly on their speed dial, and you're one of the people they call to adapt certain pieces of IP, to rewrite certain scripts that aren't working. She had the respect of the people in Hollywood you want the respect of. What this movie seems like, because I don't think this really falls into the Tuscan Sun or Cats or Dogs category. No. This movie mm-hmm. seems like her attempt to say, when I make a movie, you know, soup to nuts, this is what they're going to look like. And I want the opportunity to make movies like this. And I, as usual, I blame Harvey Weinstein for not recognizing what he had here, because a movie like this breaks through almost entirely because of the marketing campaign. Mm-hmm. Almost be critical praise, which this movie had. Things like the Waldo Salt Screenwriting Award at Sundance, which this movie won, and then strong marketing campaigns highlighting those things and highlighting why this is essential. And it failed, and it tanked her career as a potentially really exciting indie director, which is clear to me that's what she wanted. That's why you make a movie like this at this point in your career, and probably had an incredibly lucrative career directing studio movies.
I agree with everything you're saying. I also just feel like, just to touch on this for a second, because, you know, Chandler and I have talked about this a little bit before, just in terms of around this film and what have you, but also our mutual love of Almost Famous. This is a moment, we're witnessing the moment when Sarah Pauly says, I don't want to be a movie star. She makes Go. She makes this movie both in 99, and then shortly thereafter, she's offered Almost Famous. She basically gets the 1 yard line on Almost Famous and then decides that she doesn't want that career. And more power to her. Like, I think the films that she's written and directed are magnificent. I think she's a tremendous actor when she acts. She's a tremendous writer-director when she does that too. But I think that mixed with the story she's told about the Harvey Weinstein component of her not willing to play his game, whatever that might very well have entailed. I think all of these things lead to this film not getting the support that it needed to in terms of its release, in terms of the way that this film should have been marketed. And that's all, you know, sad and disappointing, because I think that this is a really special movie that kind of gets lost in this, you know, undertow of, you know, added to the list of Harvey Weinstein, you know, shitty situations. But
it's such a wonderful performance. And I think, you know, even in her taste in casting, you can see that Audrey Wells is like an auteur. I mean,
oh, for sure. Great cast.
Yeah. We could talk about this more, but I was thinking about this movie and like, what would it be like if the actors instead were like, I don't know, like Antonio Banderas or George Clooney in the Stephen Ray role. Yeah. And like, I'm trying to think of like an actor, like Claire Forlani or something.
They made the movie you're pitching. It's called Autumn in New York. It has Richard Gere and Winona Ryder.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the worst movies ever made.
but I to your point, Chandler, because I think that this is worth highlighting, the bench on this movie is really deep. You've got Tracy Letts in this film. Mm-hmm. You have Carrie Preston in this movie. Obviously, Jean Smart, who we've talked about. Like, this movie is Sandra really well cast. Sorry?
Sandra Oh, who likes...
Yeah. Sandra Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
Jasmine Guy.
Jasmine Guy, sure. It's a really interesting movie, and
who's really good.
She is great. She's, and I would argue she's always great.
The best.
Yeah.
Gina Gershon, whenever she's in a movie, even if it's a movie like Showgirls, mm-hmm. she's just so Gina Gershon, and I mean that in the best way. She's just so singular. She's so exciting. She's like electric.
a smoothie or something.
It's not like I want a quote unquote better or bigger career for her. I love what we get from her and I love how we get it from her. It's hard. It's almost like Joe Pesci. Like, God, I wish I had so much more, but like, I really appreciate what we have.
You know? Lincoln Pool in Rifkin's Festival, I believe.
I think that Chandler and I were texting about this, and Kenny, I mean, this is one of your favorite games, so I'm sure that you'll enjoy this part of it. But we were like debating whether or not Stephen Ray is miscast in this movie, and I think we both kind of came to the conclusion that he is, that he's not like totally right for the role. Chandler and I, we talked about Casey Affleck and Ben Affleck.
We talked about a modern update. But you know who I was thinking of on the way before this podcast while I was walking my dog? Is Matthew McFadden from Succession. That's who I wanted
that's
to in,
That's interesting.
Matthew McFadden with the British accent.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so is Stephen Ray miscast? No. I'll make my argument for him.
By the way, I don't think that he's like, I think he's fine in this, but I think that there's someone else that could have maybe done it better.
I like him because he's realistic. Like, the fantasy of it is Richard Gere in his loft, and he's, you know, you're making Tibetan sculptures or something together.
So,
but or like Michael Douglas.
Of like guys like this who are creepily grooming women that they meet in when they're wedding photographers and taking secret photos of them. Is that they do look and act like Stephen Ray, and it's 5 years of emotionally supporting Stephen Ray and telling him he's a genius, and you know, feeling sorry that he can't get a coffee table book published, and supporting his Patreon account. And so that's like the reality.
The beauty of this movie. So I'm gonna go. I'm gonna do my little attempt to defend an actor that I've never defended in any role.
If anybody doesn't know who Stephen Ray is, he's the lead in The Crying Game.
Yes.
Yeah. He was in an Interview with the Vampire as well. But yeah.
He's an Irishman. And he's an ugly Irishman. And I think that's important. So I tend to think about or openly discuss the attractiveness of characters, not so much the actors playing them, but the relative attractiveness of characters within the context of a piece of work more than most, because I'm of the opinion that it's incredibly important in society. And I think, well, it's not important for the average person, but like, I'm not breaking new ground to say that there is a certain privilege that comes with being an attractive person. And I think that movies sometimes, at least modern movies, shy away from this. This movie does not. He is called out at least twice for being plain or ugly. And I think, and I think you know, we're kind of dancing around it by comparing him negatively to Clooney or an Affleck brother or something like that. Like those guys. Those guys play to me a little more single white female-y or you know, that those type of movies where you can't believe how good it's going with this, you know, handsome, erudite, you know, artist man. And then, oh my God, he's a loser. But it's all on the surface with this character. But he also needs to have what he has, what Stephen Ray can bring to the role that a lot of people couldn't, which is, he can sell the pretentious, mostly legitimate sophistication this character needs in order to seduce this young woman. He needs to have something. He could wear a scarf like he knows what he's doing. He can take a beautiful picture Someone said the pictures were good enough, which I think, it was Ebert. But, you know, the pictures were fine. I don't know anything about photography.
Lady boobs, you know.
He knows a boob when he sees one.
He knows how to shoot a boob.
There is just something about him. And I'll finish this point. I will drop the mic. He fits into this very small band of being attractive enough that a woman like Sarah Polley can walk down the street with him and feel good about herself, but not mm-hmm. so attractive that society is handing him shit. And I think that that's a very big deal for this kind of character, because when Jean Smart dresses him down, a lot of it is you need someone who can worship you, and someone like me would never worship you.
Yeah, she says, you know, what do young women have that women my age don't? It's awe. And mm-hmm. I do think about that a lot, because I remember when I was like, you know, in my very young 20s, I'm in like my mid 30s now. I would have like, I mostly dated like men in their 30s or approaching 30s. And they would always be like, oh, you're so mature. And I was like, I guess I'm just a very mature person. And now that I'm in my mid 30s, I realize what I wasn't probably. And also what I have, I think, is like a real naiveness, and like a, you know, a loft apartment goes a long way when you're like a 20-year-old and being able to wear a turtleneck and stuff.
There's also like, there's the social component too, right? Like when he takes her to that bar with all the friends and like she, it's just, you know, he's seducing her on his life, less so on his appearance and who he is.
For a certain person.
I'll say about the movie that I do think is a weak spot is that her character, although Sarah Polley does like an incredible job at sort of filling in the gaps, and the first scene where he seduces her on the couch, like just the layers of hesitation and like desire, but like being freaked out and uncomfortable at the same, it's just like a masterful performance. Like I read a review with Roger Ebert, and he said a whole movie could be just said about that look and flash of emotions on her face. Such a great
performance. I mean, she's a tremendous actor. She really, really is. What were you gonna say about the flaw?
I just think her character is a little bit underdeveloped. Like you see her at this wedding, she doesn't want to be photographed, she's hiding in the, you know, pantry because she's so afraid of the way that she looks. We know she's supposed to go to Harvard Medical School.
Harvard
Law School?
Law School, yeah.
And she like she got in, but she's hiding it from her parents, and she doesn't know what she wants to do with her life. But then the movie, that just what she wants to do with her life just becomes a big question mark. And she's thrown into this relationship. She has one friend, which I really do appreciate that she has one female friend that you see throughout the movie. But generally, like, you know, he's supposed to be shaping her into this great artist, but like 5 years goes by and she doesn't even have the confidence to take a photograph. So it's just like, it's very weird, because it's like the scenes, the movie really is so invested in him. And it's almost like the movie undermines like the female subjectivity, because even though it's a critique of like women in relationships with men and kind of basing their whole identity on this guy that's kind of grooming them and shaping them into being kind of a mirror image of himself, it's still like the movie doesn't even want to investigate the female protagonist that's having that experience at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I want to agree that the moment at the end, and we're going to jump around, obviously, but the moment at the end where we find out that she's a successful professional photographer is such an afterthought.
Yeah,
that it's odd that we don't really get a sense of her success professionally, but.
I agree. I wish it, I mean, I think Ebert said it, but I felt the same way. Like, there is something so powerful about the scene when she leaves him, or when he like kind of gets her to leave him and he's in the window and he's no longer in the window. And it was just so heartbreaking. And what you desire as an audience member for Sarah Polley at that point is for her to go a third way. You know, obviously her family is toxic, and obviously this relationship was toxic. You know, it was toxic in the exact opposite way, which made her feel for a while like the hole in her heart was being filled. Mm-hmm. But neither of these things worked, and the only person that she really could rely on at that point was herself. And that sounds like a cliche, but I think that's true. And I do wonder what that third way would have been for the character. But I do think that there is something to the idea that she became a photographer. There is something to the idea that, like, I don't think the movie is so clearly saying that this is a bad man as much as this is a sad man. And that he was totally wrong as much as, like, there was good there, but only as it, like only as a byproduct of how it benefited himself. right? So like, I think, all right, so the scene you were talking about, the scene where they, the first time he's with Tracy Letts and the rest of their friends and they're talking about, I mean, he's, you know, to his great credit, Stephen Ray is 20 years ahead on you know, white people writing black characters and cultural appropriation and such. That scene is a, that scene is wish fulfillment. That is like the group of friends that I always wish I had, right? The people who sit around, get drunk and talk about interesting things and only occasionally have had it. But I get it on this podcast all the time. his wish fulfillment is, you know, what Gene Smart was saying, is to have someone look at him with awe, but also to have someone to mentor, right? And I do think he would have taken great pride in her success as an artist, as it reflected upon himself. But that is a good byproduct if she actually feels, if she actually feels like she has succeeded.
Her pictures of boobs are far surpass his.
The top notch. best in the biz. I'm just going to read the synopsis of Guinevere for our listeners who haven't watched it, which I imagine is most of them. Harper Sloan, played by Sarah Pauley, is a young woman from a privileged background who feels stifled by her family. When she meets Connie Fitzpatrick, played by Stephen Ray, an older man who's a photographer, she's intrigued and tempted to run away with him to become his muse and apprentice. She then finds out a bit of he's a bit of a cad and returns to her family, but not for long. The couple decide to go off to Los Angeles together, and along the way, Harper finally begins to chase her dream of being an artist. This film was written and directed by Audrey Wells, as we mentioned. It opened on September 24th, 1999, against Double Jeopardy, Jacob the Liar, Mumford, and Simon Says. Through a murderer's row of a weekend. It would go on to make $660,000 on a $2 million budget. It has 86% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 54% from audiences. I'm just going to read a quick snippet of the Ebert review. He gave it 3.5 out of 4 stars and said, "Despite all the piety of conventional opinion, people will insist sometimes on falling in love with inappropriate partners. No thoughtful person is ever looking for an appropriate partner in the first place. They're looking for the solution to their own needs and dreams. If you find what you need, that's the partner you want, no matter what your partner, no matter what your parents or society tell you. Heaven help the spouse who's been chosen for appropriateness." Writing these words, I realized that Guinevere tells the same story as American Beauty, with the ages and sexes reversed. The middle-aged Kevin Spacey character lusts for a high school cheerleader for the same reason that Harper knocks on the photographer's door. What they both seek is affirmation that they are good, unique, and treasured. If you can find that in a lover, you can put up with a lot. There's a horrible, perfect, brilliant moment in this film when Harper's society bitch mother, played by Jean Smart, finds out that their relationship and comes to call. She stalks the shabby loft in her expensive clothes and smokes a cigarette with such style that he puts out his own.
That's a great little thing. And in icy disdain,
she says, "What do you have against women your age?" And answers her own question, "I know exactly what she has that I haven't got. Awe." She's right, but you can't blame him. To be regarded with awe can be a wondrous aphrodisiac. It's a very interesting review from Ebert, and I would tell our listeners to read the whole thing, because I do think that this movie grapples with a lot of stuff that I don't feel like, and I don't want to speak for you, Kenny, but I feel like Ebert's spotty on some of this stuff in the reviews that we've read in 99. I feel like his review of American Beauty is a perfect example of sort of, I don't want to say a misinterpretation, but just kind of, he just got it wrong on American Beauty, and yet somehow he gets it right on this one, which I thought was interesting.
I agree with you, man. I had the exact same feeling reading this, particularly because he references American Beauty in this review. I didn't think about American Beauty once watching this.
Neither did I.
I can't really, you know, cognitively understand why I didn't make that connection. Same year and kind of, you know, similar premise. Out of ages and genders reversed, it's not. It's the same. Ages and genders. I don't know what he's talking about, but the thing about American Beauty that will always bother me was the lack of judgment at all, and not only that, I think that they were rooting Kevin Spacey's character on throughout the movie.
100%.
But there was a lack of judgment, and if anything, they were saying, this is what you need to regain your male virility.
Yeah.
This movie is full of judgment, but I think comes down on the side of, yeah, there are really bad, really fucked up situations here. But in the end of the day, these were two people who were honest with each other and who mm-hmm. were honest with themselves about what they thought they needed at that time in their life on an emotional level and not on a sexual level. Mm-hmm. And that lack of judgment I found beautiful because then we could make our own judgments on the situation that like we're doing now in the podcast. That doesn't sound like the movie neglected to call out the elephant in the room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, listen, I don't want to relitigate American Beauty again, but I'll just say that this movie is just so much more cognizant of the layers in the relationship between these two people and the wants and desires and why they want these things. I feel like on unfortunately, American Beauty just is very binary, whereas this film is embracing the messiness and the sort of lack of definition that can come from a relationship like this between two people. And perhaps this is also a symptom of, you know, studio versus indie a little bit. You know, American Beauty is a big studio movie, even if it sort of kind of was positioned as not being, it kind of was or is. And this film feels a lot more specific in its vision and specific in what it wants to say. Yeah. And, you know, yeah, there's just the trappings of a studio. Like if this was, let's just say this, if this was made by a studio, we just wouldn't get this movie. Like it would just be far less nuanced, far less messy. It wouldn't have this bummer of an ending. I'm sure, like, I'm sure that there's any number of things that they would have changed about this, which is what makes this film so special.
Well, this also foregrounds female subjectivity in a way that I don't think American Beauty has the time or interest in doing. Like, American Beauty feels to me like a John Updike novel or something. Like, it really is this, like, male yeah. wish fulfillment fantasy. And you're always aligned on Kevin Spacey's side. And he deserves to get everything because he's been kind of castrated and persecuted in response to kind of the forces of capitalism. And in this movie, there's like so much nuance and subjectivity in the Sarah Polley character, and she actually has her own agency, you know, and even though she is trapped in this kind of grooming relationship, she has way more power and control. She tries to leave him halfway through the movie and comes back to him, and mm-hmm. and you feel like even if she's sort of in this relationship, and some people might, and all the other women around her and her family are saying kind of like, you're trapped and you're going to be in this for 5 years. And at the end, what do you get out of it? She kind of wants that experience and she's searching for something bigger than herself and her family and an identity. And he offers that to her. I keep thinking about the movie An Education too, which I think is.
Oh, sure. Sure. Yeah. That, no, I absolutely see that. Yeah, I mean, I fully agree with you on the American Beauty of it all. You know, I remember when Kenny and I did the episode, you know, one of Kenny's very astute observations is how kind of vicious they are to Annette Bening's character in that movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's a brutal indictment of that character.
Yeah.
Sexuality and kind of repulsive.
All of it. Yeah. I mean, and the same thing can be said obviously for the Thora Birch character and the Mina Suvari character as well. I mean, I don't think that they're not really given much. I mean, Thora's given a little bit of agency, but for the most part, to your point, this film, the women in this movie are not just empowered, but like, they're defined. They're defined in a way that is just very sort of, as I said, very specific and very kind of subtle and nuanced.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So I just on a kind of side note, whatever, I one of the things that I don't think works in this film that I really didn't like was the score. it's not good. I just found it really heavy-handed. I felt like the emotions were there, and it was, in fact, it was so heavy-handed that it felt it, you know, Miramax was known for getting involved in post and fucking with movies that they felt like they weren't working or doing things that they felt like they needed to. And this score felt like they were just like, they're not going to get it unless we absolutely hammer them over the head with some of the emotional beats. That's my two cents worth on the score.
Yeah, it's a shame because everything else is so nuanced. Like the cinematography, I thought it was a really great looking movie. Obviously shot on film. She really lets like scenes and shots play out and kind of hangs out on moments. You know, the editing is really driven to kind of highlight that sense of intimacy between the characters. Beautiful like production design also. Yeah, the score is
for sure.
It kind of is infantilizing. I feel like it kind of telegraphs
100%.
And it's like an insult to kind of the sophistication of the storytelling.
Yeah, it's really hammy. Like it's just kind of really unnecessarily cloying at times. It also weirdly reminded me of the score from Titanic a little bit at times. Just like those very kind of like that electronic kind of that, I don't know, the melodrama of it that kind of defies the movie a little bit. I don't know.
It makes me wonder if people who were involved in this movie from post-production on thought this was like a traditional romance. And that seems to be like some of the disconnect that some people thought that, and I think this plays into what I was saying in the beginning, which is like having a 50 something year old man and a 20 something year old woman, in a romance was never considered taboo. I mean, the great couple of the first century of Hollywood was Bogey and Bacall, and he was 30 years older than her, and no one said anything about it for years. I've never heard anyone say anything about it to this day. Yeah. So I think that you'd have to almost not watch the movie to accompany it with a score, not watch the movie critically at least, to accompany it with a score like that. But it didn't bother me as much as I think it bothered you. Cause I guess I straight up didn't think the music was that bad, but I hear what you're saying.
I think there were moments when it took me out of it. Specifically, I thought the credits in particular, like it opens with this just like really over the top score over these kind of oddly, you know, I don't know, maudlin. It's just something about the way that it opened. And then I have to say it hurt the scene a little bit for me in the parking lot. I think it's a really great scene. And I think just dial the score down a little bit and it would have just knocked it out of the park. But instead it took me out of it a little bit.
Sophia Coppola treatment. Like,
yeah,
the band Air should have done the score.
Yeah, seriously. Or Phoenix. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I just frankly wonder because, you know, like what the big difference between this and American Beauty, aside from everything, is like, okay, so American Beauty at a script level could have been finer if it were directed in a less, I want to use the term masculine and also want to use the term insecure. So it's somewhere in that kind of world, right? Mm-hmm. This idea of like, well, we got to make sure everyone knows that we're like, you know, we're for the guy. Okay. So aside from that, I feel like the packaging of American Beauty was very commercial. In a forward-thinking way, like that was that Thomas Newman who wrote the score, right? Like That's a, is it? That score? Yes. That's a very famous score. That score was emulated for the next 10, 12 years in all sorts of different movies and TV shows. The
one of his 14 Oscar nominations
that he doesn't win. Oscars. Yeah. he never wins, but that score was very unique. The way it was shot was very interesting. The way color was used in that movie is very interesting. The heightened performances, the almost Burton-esque, depiction of the suburbs, like everything about that was heightened. And then when you bring up Sofia Coppola and using air and think of Sofia Coppola's movies, which are very stylized in their own way. This movie is not stylized, right? In fact, like this is, I made the joke about it in the Astronaut's Wife episode, how that is kind of done in a 90s house style. This is kind of done in the 90s indie house style, right?
Totally.
This kind of feels like Miramax, and Miramax is not really indie, but Miramax's version of indie. So I do wonder if this movie would have been improved or not and no shade thrown at Audrey Wells, who I really do think did an amazing job with this movie, but if a more traditional auteur in the Sofia Coppola, vein, were to do this movie.
The reason the movie wasn't successful is because the entire industry has so many examples of men in their 50s dating impressionable women in their early 20s that want some of their power or want to emulate their careers and don't get to have that and are totally disposable. And, people don't want to see that. They don't want to see that kind of figure actually in a realistic fashion. They kind of want the romantic fairy tale of it. And it's so interesting that a studio that perpetuated that and caused so much trauma and harm to women that age, would have released this film. It's so interesting,
I couldn't agree with you more. It's antithetical in so many ways to Miramax. And so it's kind of bizarre that they made it. I mean, this movie is oddly iconoclastic in the way that it's bucking so many Hollywood kind of conventions, if you will. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's so interesting that Harvey Weinstein is the producer of a movie that's literally about all of the incredibly horrific behavior that he perpetuated throughout his entire career.
I think Harvey Weinstein probably, I think he probably saw this movie and saw himself and Stephen Ray in a positive way.
Probably.
I do. Probably. I think he thought, okay, some of them, some of the guys who like the younger girls, like every guy, we all like the younger girls, right? Well, some of them aren't quite as successful as me, Harvey Weinstein. And it's good if I'm able, if I could do the Stephen Ray thing, but actually offer them a 3-picture deal. I'm a great guy. I'm the good version of this guy. This guy just wants to be me and that'd be okay. So that doesn't seem that weird to me.
That's fair.
What I love about it is, all right, so to what you guys are saying, this movie could never be made by a man, period, full stop. It just couldn't, because the conclusions it draws, a man wouldn't come to. Just like we talked about, again, I don't know why Astronaut's Wife he's coming up, but why men are obsessed with making movies about pregnancy and they always do a bad job, because we could never understand it. Pregnancy is not bad or good. Pregnancy is not fun or not fun or scary or serene. It is a lot of different things at once. And American Beauty depicts this relationship as just a great time. Just a hot, sexy time. Whereas this movie depicts this relationship as not all bad, not all good, not all manipulative, not all positive. A lot of really interesting things happen over the course of this relationship between these two characters. And like she says in the beginning of the movie, a line that I would have hated if they didn't actually follow through was, I don't know if he was the best man I ever met or the worst man I ever met. Because you really don't. You know he's neither of those things in the end of the day. But he is neither of those things. And in a lot of movies, you are going to land on you're like fucking Autumn in New York. He's the best man you ever met. And in a bad version of this movie, he's an old ass rapist and he's the worst man you ever met. Like, it's just the multitudes in this relationship. I just don't think a man would have
gone there.
Gone there. is the right way to put it.
I think that's what's cool about it. And it kind of goes back to Ebert's point of sort of how they're both a projection for each other. Like, she needs Stephen Ray's character to feel like she has a chance of kind of making herself over in a different identity and an artistic capacity that's separate from her family. And then he needs her to kind of feel, I mean, he kind of needs a perpetual standing Guinevere to feel like he's artistically relevant again. And that he has like,
he needs the validation.
Vitality in his life. And I think what is cool about this movie is that there are moments where the relationship isn't this glamorous fantasy, and there's kind of cracks and fissures in the reality of actually that he is not a successful artist, and he is a bit pathetic. And
There's the scene where she takes the camera is one of the best scenes in the movie as well.
Oh yeah,
when in the car when she finally takes a picture, it's
teeth that have just fallen out.
I'll talk about that for hours. One of the great like that is a script move, and that is one of the great script moves I've ever seen.
No other movie would show like the sexy older man breaking his teeth on like what is it, like a taco or something.
It's like a sandwich.
It just shows oldness.
I broke my teeth on the sandwich.
Impotency and embarrassment, and like the veneer just being shattered in front of her. I couldn't believe
it. And not having the money, and then needing to sell the camera. Movie. Like, you're just like, it's so brutal.
And this gets to another point, because you said that it's not it wasn't glamorous. I'd also say that the Downs weren't glamorous, right?
Yeah.
So like, as Phil knows, I love A Star Is Born, but it kind of treads on similar territory.
The Bradley Cooper version?
Yes.
I love that movie too.
Oh, I love it so much.
There you go.
But it does kind of mine similar territory, and it doesn't almost in any way make the kind of comments that Guinevere makes about it. And the thing about A Star Is Born, and A Star Is Born is just pure Hollywood. Like, I love every fucking second of it. It works for me on such a deeply emotional level, because it pulls all the levers of like, this is what I want movies to do for me. But the Downs are glamorous. These are like drug-fueled, vase-throwing fights, people dragged out of pools and dragged out of tubs and gorgeous hotel rooms in the backstage and all this shit. Like, even his death is kind of fucking glamorous.
Oh yeah, so, it's in that great garage.
Yeah. Isn't that beautiful house? Like, that's cool, a way to go out. That's a Jim Morrison death. So this nothing about this is good or sexy or romantic or glamorous.
No. Yeah.
It's so strong. Like the nuance, the subduedness of it all is so powerful.
The subtlety of it. Yeah.
It's so powerful to me.
Go ahead.
The reality. It's the Stephen Ray of it all, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The fact that Sarah Polley has like her original teeth. Like, I've never seen teeth like in it. Like, and she's
got like
beautiful, but she looks like a real person, and it's always like the realism is always foregrounded, and the cynicism of those other women, and the kind of mix of like, I think that last scene with all of those women at the table where they're all talking about their different relationships with him as he's dying, and you know, you see this kind of range of emotion. You know, you have this really his new young girlfriend that's like absurdly upset. You have some women that can like barely shed a tear for him and just think he's pathetic. You have some that are almost like nostalgic for what's happened, or some that, you know, you feel like Sarah Polley's character is just finally processed enough trauma that she can actually go back to see him and not kind of have so much resentment for him anymore. It's really interesting.
It's pretty incredible that we can talk about these. Like, it's a testament to this film that all of these really complex ideas can exist within it.
Yeah.
But it makes me mad that it's not part of like the essential film canon that, you know, even a woman making movies, like I always just kind of assumed that Guinevere was like super lame.
It has a super lame title.
Yes.
and him calling her Guinevere.
Ugh, makes me dry up.
Yeah. Let's get in there a little bit.
Wow. Can I just? I want to just say one
what
thing here before
at.
We.
Yeah.
No. I just want to say one thing.
Was like, I shall now call you Princess Guinevere. Here you are on your throne. I'd be like, I got this Tinder date is over.
And I don't know if you. I don't know if you guys know. I mean, like, I had to look it up, so I'm not trying to act like some kind of fucking English major genius. But did you guys look up Guinevere, like in the King Arthur myths, like what her thing was?
I mean, that's all I know is she was his girl, right?
Yeah, but she like cheated on him with Lancelot. Like she like kind of brought that. She like kind of brought down the you know the Arthurian Empire, you know, because she's a harlot, of course. It's not. I mean, there are other books apparently. I don't know, but there are other books where she's treated more thoughtfully, but in general, I don't think Guinevere is a particularly sympathetic character, and it does just kind of feel like it's a nice word to say Guinevere, like,
yeah,
and more of like, and it looked nice in the title, so you know, it definitely lost a point for its title and overuse.
Yeah, I don't love the name, but I just want to quickly rewind for one quick second, just because it's worth noting, and I think it speaks to the Sarah Pauly component of not just this film, but of her career and what she would go on to make. But apparently, during this non-union shoot in San Francisco, crew members struck, and she joined the picket line. So the striking crew members reported that they were quite touched by her action, which was more than a gesture, but rather a sincere belief in workers' rights. On her part, Pauly called her union, the Screen Actors Guild, to tell them of her action, and the union representative told her that they'd back her if she crossed the picket line. So SAG assumed that she was calling to ask whether she could defy the protest. Shocked and dismayed, Pauly stayed out with the strikers, and the strike ended after 3 days when their grievances were met. Subsequently, Pauly has stated that she has been told that she lost several job offers due to this incident, as producers didn't want a union quote-unquote militant, despite the film industry being a craft industry dominated by guild union system. And I just think it's very interesting.
Yeah, she's a political activist. You know, as a teenager, she famously, I think, like, punched an RCMP officer, or she got her teeth knocked out by an RCMP officer in a protest. Mm-hmm. And you know, like, I think after this experience, it's like she's been very public about the fact that she just didn't want to kind of play this Hollywood industry game and become like a Gretchen Mol or something. You know, there's so many other actresses of her caliber that did play the kind of game and were sort of at the behest of someone like Harvey Weinstein. And sometimes it worked out for them. Sometimes they became like a Gwyneth Paltrow and won an Academy Award for Shakespeare in Love. But there's so many other women that were just kind of like brutalized by that experience.
Absolutely.
And the fact that she became such a formidable filmmaker after that is like a huge testament to just the amount of intelligence that she has. And it's such an emotional, cerebral performance also.
I was just going to say, it's one of those things where – yes, she's obviously, I mean, Sarah Pauly is obviously brilliant, and the fortitude she has and the zero fucks that she gives and the pushes that she does, and I think it's great. But I also think that Harper, in lesser hands, would have seemed far less, not even just articulate, but just Sarah can do things without words, and there's just this. There, you sense the layers that's going on. You sense the conflicts that are going on inside Harper. I mean, just looking at like to get into the plot of it. You know, the film opens. She's at her sister's wedding, played by Emily Proctor, and she meets Connie outside, and he tells her that he's a photographer, and she specifically says, "Please don't take my picture." Now, again, that this is a scene where. Just the way that they look at each other, just what you can see the gears moving in her head. Like there's just it's really special what she brings to the character.
Yeah, I mean, if you have an actress like that and it's your first time as a writer director, I think she makes your job very easy.
Sure.
Because like she's filling out these layers in your script that you don't even know are there. And
100%.
Do you guys think that they have good chemistry though?
That's a very loaded question, Chandler. Because,
well, it's. I mean, they have to have good chemistry, otherwise, like the whole movie kind of hinges on that.
Yeah, they. I. Maybe I'm just a homer for the movie. I think they have the chemistry they're supposed to have. Right? Like
chemistry.
Which is to say, it's not perfect. Like if it were perfect and it transcended the age difference, because I think that's plausible in a movie, right? I think A Star Is Born does that. So if it transcended the age difference, then I think it kind of undercuts a lot of what this movie's trying to do. So it's not perfect, but there is something there. I get why she goes back. You know, I get like that, and particularly in contrast to her shitty ass family, but like, I get why she goes back.
I think that to that point, I think that there are moments when I completely bought them. Generally speaking, or at least one of them that I can pinpoint was, I think when he was, not when he throws her this birthday party later, but like I like the birthday party fine, even though I don't understand the people that are there, but no, that's neither here nor there. There's like the same children thing. And old people. You know, and I'm just like, who are these people?
I want to say, like, I have my notes for Phil, I don't mean to just cut you off, so please don't forget, but I have my notes for this. And I was just looking over it like at some point. I think I spent 80% of this movie being like, I think I hate it, but I'm not sure. I think I might hate this, but like, and then at one point, like, I just call it out. I'm like, but do I hate this or I love this? So that birthday party scene still happened while I hated it. And I was still like on some, all right, this is a predator. Like, yeah, so yeah, I'm like, yeah. So I'm like, where is he finding all of these accomplices? Because that's what they are.
Yeah,
you guys,
yeah.
You have entire many colors of venison into
who came
it. It was so weird.
Who wants to join me? Who wants to join me for my college student girlfriend's birthday party? And everybody in town is like, we're there.
I know.
So, but yeah. now that I don't think he's. Can you be but two things? Can you still be a thoughtful predator? It's very hard to say.
But what I was going to say was there's a moment, and it's before that birthday party, where they're just having people over, I think at his loft or whatever, and she's in the center of some sort of a situation. I think it might be a cake or something.
Yeah.
And she is just glowing. I'm just like, I get it, because Harper has been living her life as some sort of a wallflower or someone who just doesn't feel loved or doesn't feel cared about. And now there's all these people in a room and she's got this spotlight on her and she can just blossom and be this thing that she wants to be. Like, that's incredibly special. And that made me buy into their relationship. That being said, the scenes when they're sexual together, no. Like, they are not it was gross.
The scene where she's sitting on his lap and he's like,
yeah, don't like it, don't like it.
Yeah. You may not supposed to like it. The scene you're talking about, the
question, you know, and I feel like that's a real interesting thing about, I think, when women get under the camera, right, and do these sex scenes, because in American Beauty, when he's putting his hand down under the bathtub covered of rose petals and Mina Suvari is, you know, orgasmically responding, it's like, ooh, this is pure cinema. This is a Fellini movie right now.
But that's also, there's a magic realism to, I'm not making excuses for American Beauty. I'm agreeing with you and underlying that the fantasy
it's a dream sequence. It's not magic realism, right? So it's a dream sequence. I would also say, like,
it's very stylized, for sure.
Yeah,
but the reality of these relationships is that it actually is you know, uncomfortably sitting on a chair while Stephen really like reaches down below your Levi's, and you're like, "Ew, I don't like this. Why am I here?"
Just call me Guinevere. Get out of here.
I think that more when you see female subjectivity at work. It is uncomfortable and it does make you think. And I think it isn't financially successful a lot of the time because we haven't seen like the full range of expression of what happens when women get behind the camera and actually tell their own stories. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Audrey Wells had an experience like this because she writes so truthfully about it that how could she not have been a Guinevere at some point?
Yeah, I mean, I think to your point, Chandler, I think what makes that scene upsetting is the realism of it, right? Like, to your point, when you're watching that scene, you just, you don't want to watch that, right? Like, you want to turn away because it feels too real. I would say the same about the scene when he seduces her for the first time and says, I want to see your form and all that sort of nonsense. It's so gross. And how quickly he's able to get her pants off, like almost before she even really notices what's happening. And that shot, that wide shot of her like running, basically like scurrying to one end of the couch and saying, I reserve the right to say no. And then she attacks him and kisses him. But it's again, like, these are very complicated, like, hot button things that she's navigating incredibly well.
And I think when women are in this position in relationships, you know, it's hard mm-hmm. to understand in your own mind if you like it or if you don't. And there, even if it's a fully consensual, like, romantic relationship where you are in love, you look back at it and you go, was it okay that I was dating that, like, man in his 30s or 40s? What was that about? You know, and I think so much of the time it's women wanting to be that person themselves, and they think that kind of the romantic relationship is sort of the way to approximate it, or they don't know. Like, everything is kind of a projection of our own sort of fantasies and desires.
I also remember being a younger person in my 20s and being in Hollywood and thinking, how am I ever going to compete with these guys who have money and their cars, and they live alone, and they clean their shit up, and they know how to cook, and they can go on a vacation, and they like, and all this shit.
They clean their shit up.
Like, they don't have takeout boxes everywhere. They don't have water bottles strewn throughout their cars. What chance do I have?
But look at you now. You paused during your own podcast because you were cooking a meal.
Well, I wasn't cooking it. My wife.
Someone else was cooking the meal.
My older wife. Don't. That's right. I'm the Guinevere now. Which is to say, I recognized just how seductive that lifestyle would be to someone who's living like me. You know, someone who's living in an apartment on Olympic Avenue with two other people my age and leaving takeout boxes strewn about. Now, most women didn't do that, but some did. So,
I think it's very interesting to see how, how essentially they slow play their relationship as well. Mm-hmm. And the idea that, like, she stays over, but he spends the night in his dark room. The first time, right. This idea of sort of trying to, I don't know if seducing is the right word, as it is that he's sort of warming the water and not trying to scare her away.
I would say seducing is the right word.
Okay.
But it's that's so part of the seduction. When,
sure.
It makes that offer for her to live with him. And she, and she kind of asks, like, is it conditional on us? Like, where am I going to sleep? And,
I do love that she, this is one of my favorite lines that, and the way that Sarah Polley delivers it, where she says, oh, you're mistaking me for someone with potential. Which is like the breadth of that scene, when you think about it, goes from basically, like, she's giggling. She's like, there's a lot of, like, uncontrollable laughter. She's just not used to this situation, or more importantly, finds it a little bit sort of embarrassing to some degree or another. And then him slowly kind of getting her comfortable enough that she goes and sits on the couch and he's able to just kind of talk to her from a distance. I mean, it honestly feels like he's trying to, like, tame or corral some sort of an animal.
Want to be there. And it's so interesting when you realize later that it's like a pathological thing and he's done this multiple times.
Who else could deliver that line? Because I don't have the answer is nobody. I mean, anybody could say those words, but nobody she else could deliver that line in a way that doesn't fucking destroy that character.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
No.
And again, it's because I think honestly, part of it, it's the emotional intelligence, but it's just the straight up intelligence that Sarah Pauly brings to her characters. I mean, Kenny and I have both talked, we did an episode on Go, and we talk about that first chapter of Go, which is Sarah Pauly chapter. She's so fucking good in that movie.
Yeah.
And she brings so much depth to it, and that sardonic intellectualism, all that kind of stuff that she brings to it, that, yeah, it's on some level, it's a shame that we don't have more performances from her. But to Kenny's point, she kills that line because of everything she brings.
She could do anything. She really could. I mean, it is too bad we don't have more performances from her. But
we have Splice.
You think of Go, she is so cool in that movie in a high status kind of way. She high statuses like, everybody.
Like she's in a Tarantino movie. Like,
yep.
She's the exact opposite. She's pure confidence in that movie. Yeah. Even in the scene with Tim Lee Oliphant where it's possible she's going to get killed, she is confident and cool.
Yep.
So she's a remarkable actress, and in a weird way, it almost makes sense that she said fuck this shit, because this shit is not for someone like her, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because
very many Guinevere's as a young actress that age either. I mean, how many scripts was she getting, you know, how that were even like up to the standards of what she must have been looking for? And
I mean, it's speaking of Go, I mean, it was a process to get her to do Go. I mean, Lyman has talked about how, you know, how hard it was to get her to make that movie. And I think part of it is because of the fact that she knew I can fucking kill this thing and it's going to be big, you know, it's going, or at the very least, like it's going to make an impression. Like when I think about that first line she has in Go, where the woman at the cashier is saying like, you didn't double coupon. She says, I did look at the coupon where it says double coupon. She says something along the lines of, I used to be you. You're not better than you think you are. And she says, look at where it got you. Like it's just that one fucking thing. And you're just like, oh, she's a fucking star. Like she can do anything.
Yeah.
And you know, and, to her credit, she's like, yeah, I'm getting the fuck out of here is what I'm doing. So then we're at this point in the movie where basically Connie has convinced her to stay with him. Sir,
hold on, before we do this, I have another game. All right. Sarah Pauly more or less goes away as an actress around 2000, 2001, right?
She does My Life Without Me, which is excellent as well. And
she does the Hal Hartley movie, that weird No Such Thing movie.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So what year is her last real...
I mean, Splice was her last movie, and that was probably in the mid-2000s.
All right, so I'm having a hard time with this game in my own head. What
great.
What movie do you wish Sarah Pauly starred in post-2005?
Post-2005?
Yeah, after she was gone.
Oh, it's
like a what did we lose? Because I as you guys are thinking, I don't even really have a someone who took her spot, like the next Sarah Pauly up. You know it's not even worth discussing. But it's like
I have one.
Yeah, go for it.
I have one that I think is sort of an answer to your question. I think she and I loved Greta Gerwig in 20th Century Women, but I actually think that Sarah Pauly could have been great in that role.
It's a good answer. It's a good answer.
She could have been really good.
Though I would How say
is, Sarah Pauly? Is she like a little bit older than Greta Gerwig?
She has probably the same like birthday as me. She's 1 year older than me.
40, I'm not gonna say how old she is.
She's 41.
She's 41.
So I feel you on that, Phil, a lot. Like I think she would have been great in that role and great in that movie and fit really nicely. I'm thinking about or at least I'm trying to think of a lead role, right? I'm trying to think of like, I think Guinevere and, you know, not discounting what Chandler said about it kind of being Stephen Ray's movie. I think of it as a Sarah Pauly movie. And I think the first third of Go was clearly a Sarah Pauly movie. And I think that we are missing something that could have been really essential. You know, Greta Gerwig, I guess, did it for a while where Noah Baumbach was making these Greta Gerwig movies. But I wonder what like that would be. I don't really have it. I mean, I don't really have the answer.
You know, another answer that is a little bit weird, but I'm going to throw it out there. And it's not really, again, it's not really the answer to your question in terms of like a leading role. The movie that comes to mind for a leading role is weirdly The Ring. Like, I actually think she could have been really cool in the answer. Naomi Watts role in that.
That's a really good answer, Phil. Shocking.
It's so funny. I feel like I can't think of anything. It's almost like a movie would have to be invented to contain her, you know? It's like, because of who she is, like, the movie would have been built around her and we would have had that movie. But
I'm going to give one other role that I think is
kind of comes to mind, but
what was that?
Oh, she could have been great in that. Yeah.
Like
Eternal Sunshine.
Oh yeah. I would like to see her. Now, this is before 2005 and this isn't a lead role, but I think she would have fucking killed it in the Hilary Swank role in Insomnia.
Oh,
that's interesting.
I actually like the idea of her as almost a Frances McDormand and Fargo-esque cop. And I always felt like Hilary Swank was the weak link in that movie. It didn't make a lot of sense to me, but I love that idea. The other thing, again, this is actually like a 2000 movie and this would never be here, but this is the kind of role I would have loved to see her play is in The Contender. There's that reporter.
Oh, yeah.
Who wound up going on to be in Cold Case. So she's a billionaire now. But but that kind of role, that like dogged, smart, you know, but tough. And I don't know, those kind of things.
Yeah. I mean, I think
she would make a really good, I should know this name, Clarice Starling.
Yeah.
For sure.
She has like Jodie Foster's, you know.
I also think she's like, she's really funny. And I don't know that she ever did a ton of funny roles. I actually think she could have been interesting in the Cameron Diaz role in Being John Malkovich.
Oh, she would have been really great. Yeah.
Like, I think that she's got like, you know, she really could have done anything. And I think she would have succeeded. But it's just one of those things where you just look at her and just say like, yeah, I mean, whatever you want, you could do
Orange
it.
Orange is the New Black. Like, that would have been cool.
Yeah, for sure.
I really love Diane Kruger in the Bridge on FX.
Yes,
but that would have been good for her.
The Melanie Laurent role in Beginners.
Mike Mills. Because there's something about what he does that does kind of
fit for sure. I think she's, I mean, she very much fits in that like Miranda July, Mike Mills kind of universe. She's endlessly fascinating. And I wish she acted more. But
a bit of a coldness in certain roles that is actually kind of extraordinary that you don't get to see from actresses. Like, she kind of, like, even though the camera, like, the camera loves her so much, it's also kind of like she doesn't need the camera the way that, like, other actresses are, like, very actressy and kind of, like, see me.
Totally.
That's a really good way of
it. I would actually have loved to have seen her play the Anna Torv character on Mindhunter.
Oh, and Anna Gross.
And so I like Anna Torv. I think she's great, but go ahead.
Walter White's wife on Breaking Bad.
she would have been much better.
You mean Anna Gunn's Emmy Award winning performance?
Did she win an Emmy? She did. Yeah. She won an Emmy. Yeah, you know.
I mean, for what that's worth.
I thought about the discourse around that one that will remain.
I think
good on Mad Men too.
Not as pecky.
I don't,
if that's where we're going.
Not as pecky. I don't know that weirdly, I'm not sure that I see her. She doesn't really work in period pieces that well. Movie, The Claim.
She works really well in.
Hmm?
From the 70s, she works really
That's what
well.
I was going to say, like, yeah. If she played Chloe Sevigny's role in Zodiac, for instance, or something that, where you're just like, I could absolutely see her killing that. I'm just not sure that I could. I don't know what she'd look like in the 50s. But back to Guinevere. At this point in the film, basically, Connie gets a camera for her from a pawn shop, and the pawn shop attendant clearly looks like he's done this a million times before. With like the look on the woman's face, it was just like, ugh.
So much. There's so many painful looks. Like, I keep thinking about the scene in the restaurant where they're having they meet for coffee, and then the guy in the restaurant is sitting with the woman, looks at her and gives Connie
it's so gross. It's so gross. I feel sick to my stomach. Yeah. basically she moves
that,
in.
I hate that moment, but not just because it's gross. I hate that moment because it seems to be an attempt to contrast what Stephen Ray does versus what that guy does. And it's really heavy-handed. It's a heavy-handed way of getting that out.
I agree 100%. So then basically there's one of the best scenes in the movie is the scene at the birthday dinner where with the fortune cookies.
Oh, my God.
You know what I'm talking about?
I got feelings about that one.
All of cinema.
What are your thoughts?
Would you say the best dinner in all of cinema?
Best one-liner. Like what a button on that scene.
All right. It's the best depiction of rich people I have ever seen. Period. Full stop. I will tell you why.
Okay.
Everything about it's amazing. Rich people are bored. Okay? That's one of the main things. That's what this is so embarrassing.
Succession?
No, what's her name? The actress.
Gene Smart.
That's what Gene Smart is playing, right? We're bored. Mm-hmm. We are looking for fun. I have played every game. I'm now playing it with my children. That is a rich people move, no question about it. That is bore on the floor. That is you are just pawns to me. But the moment that really strikes me as you are so rich, you have lost the fucking plot, is how the scene starts when she says, sorry, we couldn't get you a cake. We wanted the restaurant to bring one over, but they're Chinese, so they're probably blowing up a duck or something. So I guess it's fortune cookies for dessert.
So hateful.
Any reasonable mother would bake their kid a cake. That's what you do. You bake the cake.
Not even that. Just go to the grocery store. And
if you are buy not a cake? The kind of person who is going to bake a cake, go to the grocery store and buy a cake. It is so fundamentally important. If you are the laziest of the lazy, you do what she did, which is call the restaurant and say, can you bring me a cake?
I've never even heard of that.
Neither have I. But I could see it happening, a place that has dessert, I guess. And if that is impossible, you don't just give up and give fucking fortune cookies.
But who's getting a cake from a Chinese restaurant? That doesn't even make any sense.
Yeah. Someone who doesn't live in the real world, right? Someone who doesn't understand that you can't just buy your way out of every single problem. And someone who also looks at getting your kid a birthday cake as a problem instead of something to celebrate and something to enjoy with that person. So that from that beginning into the in-bed game, which made me fucking roll my eyes before it played out so beautifully and brilliantly. Everybody in that scene played it so well.
Perfectly.
Amazingly. The boyfriend that's scared to speak.
I love that.
Or the husband, I guess.
And with the shrimp that he can't pick up with the chopsticks. And then at the very end, she's like, just pick it up.
The Waldo Salt Award was given in that scene.
I am.
It's a great scene.
Brilliant line about, you will be rammed in the ass by a 12-inch cock in bed.
in the context of this.
Feels kind of redundant. Yeah.
Basically, she wants the mom is like, I played this hilarious game with my friends where we added in bed to every sentence. Let's try it with this fortune cookies.
Which everybody played 25
in
years
like
ago.
Grade school.
And I've seen this from people who maybe my mother think that something from 25 years ago is now cool and funny, and it's so inappropriate and so horrible. Go ahead.
Yep.
And people just had generic, fortunes you will have great success in bed, and then their body character says that, and it's just unbelievable.
It's like everything because
I also think that routine. We're not talking about one of the things that I think adds just beautiful tension to the scene, which is that they dial up the sound of the cracking of the cookies as they're breaking them open. And each time it happens, it's just like, oh, it's just fucking brutal.
But I want to say, like, the actual last line, I believe. I believe the last line is just pick up the shrimp. But oh, Gene Smart's last line was fuck this family.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, you don't play by her fucking rules, as twisted and toxic as they are. Fuck this family. Wow, you get right there why Sarah Polley is running to the nearest 53-year-old wedding photographer who doesn't tell her to go eat shit every day.
Yep.
So yeah. It's so
who then throws her this like surprise birthday party and makes her feel like $1 million.
That's a nice mirror to that scene, actually.
Yeah. It does.
It's
brilliantly contrasted. This movie is subtly about, or kind of in even just in a very undercover way, about how horrible it is to be a part of a toxic family and to be suffering emotional abuse from your parents all the time, and how people who are in that situation are going to run to any port in the storm, even if the port in the storm is like, you know, the fucking floorboards are crackling off and has barnacles everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, it is probably better for Sarah Polley.
And he wants to make you read like a bunch of Germaine Greer books that you're not interested in.
But then shortly after this scene, we have the scene we were talking about, which is when her mother, Deborah, shows up and has that brutal takedown of Connie, which is fantastic. And basically, Connie kind of freaks out, and he says when Harper the next day tells him that she might move out eventually, or that they should find a place together. Like, he gets all fucking witchy and cagey on her in that scene.
Yeah. She thinks that she's thinking about getting her own apartment. But she still wants to look at it and approve it with her.
Which is weird. It's weird. And then
there's this kind of additional limit on the relationship too. Like, he just keeps saying, like, all I want is like 5 years of your time, and then you can leave me.
It's
and
so
do
weird.
Whatever you want. 5 years to become like a great artist, but mostly just like have sex with me and be my like arm candy. Like, it's really strange. And it's like there's this kind of term limit, almost like a presidency or something. Wow. Like,
you know, there's a famous actor who seems to have a term limit. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but
I don't.
There's a famous actor
who
only dates women who are like 26 and under, and when they get to 26, he dumps them. Do you know who I'm talking about?
I think I have a general idea.
It's everybody's favorite actor, Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, I was going to say that's who I thought it was.
Yeah. Leonardo DiCaprio seems to have this exact same deal. It's like when you're 26, you leave the nest.
Oh, man. And until
fly.
Then you have to
fly, birdie, fly.
I don't know. It's like you think of Bar Raphael air forever, but like, no, she was 26 and on to the next. So
then Harper comes home to find Connie out cold, drunk on the floor. Then they kind of go on this road trip together, which leads us. It really the descent starts from here, where it's like then he breaks his teeth, and then it's like selling the camera in order to fix his teeth.
And another thing about that is like in another movie, like that's all right. So the symbolism is thick with that one, right? It's like there's phallic significance with selling the lens, and there is emotional significance with selling his way to make money and way to kind of provide and way to be a man. Like that's it's laid on really thick, like anybody could pick up on it. But because it has such a strong application in the plot or the narrative, you ignore it, you let it be. And now I just think the symbolism is really kind of strong and wonderful. So much so, like, I bet even this character recognize the symbolism in his own life, and that's powerful to me. So I think that
I totally agree.
It's little things like that. It's things that, like, in other movies and in other hands, you'd be like, you think I'm an idiot? Like, I can't realize what you I can't figure out what you're doing. But the way it's handled here, as just kind of the first move in a negotiation with the audience, like, I get you're smart enough to see what I'm doing. Now I'm going to play with it a little more. I love it. I love it. Love it. Love it.
I also really love, so we're now at the scene where they're driving back, they're basically, they're driving back from the friend of his who he was trying to hit up for money to try to buy some of his photos or just to basically get him money. And they're in the car and Sarah Pauly starts to laugh because she still never got to take a picture. And then she grabs her camera and starts sort of like manically taking pictures of him. And it's the only time we see through the lens of a camera is when Harper's holding the camera and when she's pointing it at him. It's fucking great.
And it's really, really great. Bleeding and he's like covering his mouth and it's great. And it's very grotesque.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And then basically the film kind of comes to a climax at this LA, this kind of like sad, downtrodden LA kind of hotel motel where basically Connie kicks her out and says like, you know, go get us some booze. He gives her obviously way too much money in order to get out of Dodge. And it's, he's looking at her as she crosses the parking lot. And she turns, she sees him in the window and then he's gone.
I thought he was going to commit suicide in that moment.
Like, so did I.
Well,
but then she 4 years later, she shows up, he's dying of apparently cirrhosis of the liver is what Wikipedia said, although I don't think that was ever specifically said. And Harper has a photography career now and all the Guinevere's, get together.
Some of whom we've How met, do we some feel, of whom we haven't.
Yeah. How do we feel about this heaven thing, fantasy thing that the film ends with? What are our thoughts on that?
I kind of hate it. I feel like it might be
okay, good.
A sort of, I mean, talking about magical realism, basically, it's funny because the ending feels so deeply cynical to me, but it's almost like this wish fulfillment fantasy that she's giving him in order to move on and mm-hmm. feel okay about, you know, dying. And she tells him this elaborate story about how he's going to die. He's going to pass through this kind of hallway and see all of his
Guinevere's
young love, beautiful women. And they'll all be kind of like either weeping about his death because he's so wonderful or, you know, painting a beautiful picture that he's inspired her to have. But I think it's kind of almost like the movie knows that men like him are deluded and pathetic and your job is to make them feel good about themselves. And even when they're dying and have kind of met the fate that they deserve, you still have to make them feel good about themselves. And the emotional
labor, even in death,
but that's what you're supposed to do. And they'll always find a younger version of you. And your job is just to kind of forget that that you ever met.
At first, as it was happening, I had similar feelings to what you were saying, Chandler. Like, I was like, I don't like this. This is dumb. But then it's also so fucking cynical about it that I was like, wait, maybe I'm on board with this.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to say, because as Chandler was talking about how much he hated it, I'm like, wait. You're talking about this like someone who liked it. You're finding a lot of value in this.
Face flying through the air like he's in the Neverending Story. But I like the cynicism and like acid of it. It's kind of badass.
There's something kind of fuck you about it. It's like, oh, we're gonna give you some weird fucking happy ending, but like, you're gonna die.
You have to die.
Like, shut the fuck up.
I think I feel the same way you guys felt, which is like, at the time, I really was like, the movie should have ended, right? Like, the movie should have ended.
Her being like, I learned some things, but I'm
different. Yeah, I learned some things. He was bad. He was good. I'm good. So I felt like that, but this is a weird thing to say. Okay, Phil, you're someone who just watched All That Jazz, right?
Indeed.
And Chandler, have you seen All That Jazz?
Yeah, you know what? It's a very similar trajectory.
Very similar, right? And it's a very similar kind of ending thing, except like in All That Jazz, I think it's like kind of Fosse.
Goes a little farther.
It goes for 45 minutes, but Fosse is giving himself that thing.
Yeah.
Whereas in this, like Polly's giving, you know, Stephen Ray this thing. And all I really want to say is like, I guarantee you, I will never forget how this movie ended. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I mean, that's why I love All That Jazz. I mean, I love All That Jazz for a million reasons, but I love All That Jazz the most because of the guy giving a fucking funeral wake crazy ass thing for himself. And I have to, it's wild and wonderful to me. But I'm never going to forget the way this movie ended. I think about it all the time. I think about death a lot. I think about how, we all have to go at some point. I know this isn't particularly profound, but like when you really, really get inside someone's mind as they're about to go, there is something profound about that, profound about how I am going to deal with the last moments of my life. And he had a plan, and the plan was to have someone, fill his head with, this impossible fantasy sequence. Now, I do wonder what it's ultimately saying about him. Like, I do see the argument for cynicism and kind of the acid you're talking about. I also kind of feel like there is a little bit of hands throwing up. I don't mean that in a bad way, but like it almost a person on death row gets the last meal kind of way. That dying mm-hmm. sucks so badly no matter what that it's kind of okay.
Giving him one last
someone one last thing before they die. Even when they're, even when they've done terrible things, but there's a lot there.
It's funny. Cause like so they give him a picture of all the Guinevere's topless.
Yeah.
And he sort of has this moment. And I had the similar feeling you did too, Kenny, which was they were like, let's give the guy one last hurrah before he dies. And then he forces the issue and says, like, tell me a fucking story, too. Like, give me the greatest. And so there's something about even just in Sarah Pauley's delivery that has a little bit of an edge to it.
Yeah.
That's sort of like, yeah, I'll fucking give this to you, I guess. Like, I'm not thrilled to have to, like, hold your hand down to the fucking pearly gates. But if I have to do it, I'll do it. And all of that gives this ending, which in anyone else's hands, I'm convinced would have just been a disaster. Somehow kind of finds a way to navigate through it with its kind of sharpness and jadedness that allows it to exist.
But these women are this like last still thing. Beholden to him. It's interesting. Like, why couldn't the movie end with a wonderful packed gallery full of people at Sarah Pauley's photography show?
Yeah.
And
he
shows up and he's like, oh, that beautiful picture, Guinevere, you still got it.
Sean Connery shows up. Weird.
Wasn't that such a connection?
That was good.
And then she's like, oh, thanks. My agent, what? I've got the cover of Vogue next week? Great. Why do they have to like all be topless again for his gaze, giving him like another picture of their naked bodies? That he can enjoy.
Yeah, I don't disagree with
it. It doesn't work. It doesn't feel right. Like it just what it doesn't feel right. And
that's why the movie is like ultimately his, I think, because like in another film about like a toxic relationship, like Blue is the Warmest Color is sort of a parallel of like a person who's in a toxic relationship with who wants to be an artist, and she kind of learns from that experience, and then at the end, they still have this encounter together. She kind of can't stay away from that person. But the movie's always that character's. And you feel like in Guinevere, like he still has all the power and agency, even in death.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I mean, to your point, the unfortunate thing is that the arc of it, because we end on him as opposed to ending on her, to your point, the movie's kind of grappling with like, whose POV is this? And most of the film is told from her POV, and yet to end the film on his journey is a little bit weird. But I mean, it's what it is.
It's Weinstein-y, to use a new
it's word. Yeah. Weinstein-y is not a word I ever want to hear again. Chandler, on this podcast, we rate these movies from 0 to 99. Zero being the lowest, 99 being the highest, 50% being whether or not you would recommend it. And if you saw it in 99, which you didn't, I did. So I'll go first. In 99, I probably would have given this film like a 70, something like that. Like, I didn't hate it. Sarah Pauley can do no wrong. It's going to, if you've got Sarah Pauley in your movie, you're probably going to get a 70 from me in one way or another. So I liked it. Watching it again with you, for you guys with this, I'm in the 80s now. I think I'm in the like I'm in the low 80s. I think that there's so much going on in this film. Her performance is great, but also just all the things that we've been able to talk about with this film, I'm just sort of really kind of taken with the layers of it and the complexity of it. And obviously now being able to look at this through the lens of 2020, this film just feels so groundbreaking and so kind of, you know, pushing so many boundaries back then, let alone today. So I really loved it. But Kenny, what did you think?
I loved it more than you. Ha ha ha. I wrote Against All Odds. I love that movie. I'm not even sure I can explain it. I did my best over the course of this podcast to explain why I love this movie so much. I gave it a 90. I'm sticking with a 90.
Nice.
Deeply
love it.
Deeply loved this movie. Also deeply loved this conversation. It's a conversation that I expected a movie like this to be able to bring out. I think we could probably have talked for another hour. Like, we barely mentioned Jean Smart. And not because, like, she's not worth mentioning. Like, just because this movie's really, really dense. But 90, that's good for a movie that I expected to be in the 30s or 40s. It was really a shocking and a wonderful experience.
Chandler, where are you?
Yeah, I really wish this movie had done for Audrey Wells what, like, the similar Miramax-produced Walking and Talking did for Nicole Holofcener. Like, I wish we could have gotten...
Right.
Four or five other Guinevere's from this filmmaker.
That's happened to a lot of female filmmakers from 99. We've seen a lot of movies from female filmmakers that we really loved, and they never got another shot or another major shot.
I mean, Kimberly Pierce being one of those, for sure. Right.
Yeah, the fact that, like, Under the Tuscan Sun is such the opposite of this movie. Yeah.
And at least she got to direct the movie. Like,
I mean,
did Antonia Bird ever direct another movie? Did
Nope.
Did what's her name? Rina Garcia ever direct another movie?
Nope.
So, you know, we've seen a lot of movies we really like from female directors, but it's just, you know.
It makes me really sad. I think this movie is like an incredibly flawed masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
And
I totally agree.
I think it deserves kind of like a Criterion rebranding, you know, like
that'd be amazing.
Yeah,
I'd love that.
Or appreciation, almost like the way that like Claudia Weill got rediscovered after Lena Dunham loved that movie Girlfriends. Like, I really think that this movie, like, I wish I'd kind of known about it. When I was 13, like passing through Blockbuster, I think it would have scared the hell out of me. but watching it now, like, I'm just like deeply appreciative of like the nuances, and Sarah Polley is like absolutely magnificent performance, and like she really is the author of the movie even more so than I think the director. I would give it like an 82, and it just gets points less because I don't like the phrase "your form." Yeah. It reminds me of like a Craigslist post I saw once where it was like middle-aged man looking for muse to live rent-free in his studio loft, like must appreciate the finer things in life,
must let me see her form. Yeah. next week we are doing The Astronaut's Wife, the aforementioned Astronaut's Wife, that Kenny brought up a couple times.
Yes.
We have Hayley Fauch coming on from Collider, and also the Witching Hour podcast. And we're going to talk about a movie that basically doesn't exist. Did you know that The Astronaut's Wife existed, Chandler? Is that a movie that you knew about?
For some reason, I keep thinking, is Charlize Theron in it?
Yes.
She is. Look at you. You're the only person that knows this movie exists. It's Johnny Depp and Charlize Theron. Yeah.
And is she sick? I feel like she might be sick.
He's impregnated her with his alien baby.
Oh.
Babies.
Babies, sorry, twice.
Whoa, crazy! That's
twins.
It's a not great movie.
It's like that movie you said, Autumn in November, or what?
New York, Autumn in New York.
I know The Astronaut's Wife does have a romantic feel, right?
Can I just say that Autumn in November is an amazingly redundant title that I really, really love.
It's like the most generic, like middle-aged, like everyone's
better. Perfect.
Yeah. Sounds pretty good, fuck. Autumn and November.
It's really good.
Let's write Autumn and November and get rich.
do it.
Astronaut's Wife, not great.
Astronaut's Wife next week,
podcast
not good.
Podcast about it, very good. So
great podcast.
We really enjoyed that podcast with Haley.
We did. As we did this.
Yes,
Chandler, thank you so much. This was everything I could have wanted it to be.
Oh,
we hope that you will come back you'll come back for another movie.
Guinevere and Sarah Polly, if you're listening, be in a movie again because you're such a
great. We love you and be in another movie. Yeah.
Because you're a wonderful writer and director too.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.